Hello and welcome to the official Scottish Rugby podcast. As usual, Rachel Malcolm, Chris Patterson, joining myself, and Jamie must be away looking after his wee one. But we've got Mike Blair coming on later on, and we'll have a kind of deep dive into his thoughts on the Autumn Nations Cup so far, as well as a look ahead to the final weekend. But before that, we have a bit of a look back at last weekend. Rachel, before we talk about the Glasgow and the Scotland game, talk us through your rugby the weekend. Were you playing?
Nope, we had our first rest weekend in God knows how long, which was super nice. But we're back this weekend against Darlington, with probably a few familiar faces lining up for them.
Does a rest weekend mean a rest weekend, or were you doing fitness all weekend?
Not the whole weekend, no. I had a Sunday off.
Well, see, well, we maybe start with the Glasgow game and move on to the international stuff before we get Mike on. We were both at Scotstoun on Monday night. It was challenging conditions wild to be commentating on, never mind playing in. but ultimately, I suppose, a disappointment for Glasgow. They almost looked as if 12 minutes to go, 2 points in the game. Once they're down to 14, it was there to be won.
It was disappointing, wasn't it? I mean, the first thing I'd say is, kind of Munster, Leinster and Ulster are almost running away with the conferences already. So it was a real challenge for Glasgow, missing their 20-plus players. But I was really impressed with the first half, with the physicality, the intensity. As you say, got to 13-15 just after Grant Stewart's try. And that was a point, that was the real tipping point in the game, wasn't it? I mean, it was, I would say Munster had periods of dominance in the first half, but then Glasgow, you know, were sticking with them, almost hit back when you didn't expect them to hit back. Immediately after that first try, brilliant score by Brycey from some set piece play. So the crucial moment in the game was just after when it got just after Grant Shearer's try, when it got to 13-15 to Munster, and just that's where the discipline kicked in. There was two or three penalties in quick succession that allowed field position, that allowed Munster to get a hold of the game. And see, all four of their tries came from kind of lineouts in and around the Glasgow 22 or close to the line, and they got those lineouts through ill discipline and penalties. So that's a frustrating thing. And yeah, just I don't know, just a one that could have, against a top team, that could have been won at home, but it's another difficult defeat to take.
Yeah, we spoke pre-game about what Glasgow needed to improve on, and that was, I suppose, at times been difficult to play against as well.
Which was better?
Yeah, they were definitely better. And you know, the attack you chatted about before the game, the attack has been all right. It was difficult to attack on Monday night. Although I've got to say, when they scored like Glenn Bryce's try, I'm thinking, why are they taking it out this driving mall? And the next thing they're scoring the corner, so it shows how much I know.
Well, even before the game, when we were standing behind the posts, and Munster were warming up just in front of us. I said to you, at the time, I don't think you can play much rugby. I genuinely don't think you got a kicking game. It was so wild. And the first half, there was a lot of good rugby, including that try. That was a fantastic try. But I was surprised at the, not to be patronising, but the skill level and the ability to show, because it was almost impossible. It was not as bad as Scotland, England and in March, in terms of the wind and the rain, but it was pretty close.
It was pretty close. You've got to credit Munster. I mean, you talked about the fact that Leinster and Ulster are matching them as well. A quality team. The fact that they've got, you know, Delalande in there in the centre at a time where so many players are away on international duty, they have a World Cup winner in there. And he was influential in the game, but I also think that the biggest influence he has on the people that are around about him. He was right in it. You talked about ill discipline. There was ill discipline throughout the game. It spilled over many times. And ultimately, when Ryan Wilson picked up that yellow card, Delalande was right in there and making sure that it was escalated to the point where there was not really a decision that the ref was left with.
It got a bit nasty, as it often does with Glasgow and Munster. But for Glasgow, that's, we mentioned Leinster, Munster and Ulster. That's Glasgow's last three games, or three of the games they've played recently. So it's been hard. And they've just got to believe in improvement and working with the players they've got at their disposal at the moment. Looking forward to welcome back some internationals when they can do so. But they travel away to Blues this weekend. So they're away, I think, Sunday night to Cardiff Blues, who are pretty sharp in attack as well. But there's no reason that Glasgow can't get that edge about them, make them, you know, hard to play against, hard to beat. And if their attack still fires like it's progressing, pick up some points on the road as well.
Yeah, a home defeat that there was positives in. And exactly to your point, they can hopefully move them into next week. So, Rach, with no rugby to play, did you spend the weekend watching Autumn Nations Cup games?
I did indeed, yes. A lot of rugby watched. It was quite nice way to relax.
I'm going to ask a really awkward question first. What was the worst game you watched?
The Wales game was pretty poor.
Did you manage the whole game? Did you watch the whole game?
I got to half time because that was the last one, wasn't it? Out of the lot.
Yeah.
And I put it on and I got to half time and I was like, nah, I need to get out of here.
And that kind of that coincided with tea time for me as well, so I was I can't.
It's an easy decision.
It was on in the background, but it was a tough old watch. Like, did you watch it, Al?
I did watch it, and I think the fact that it came off the back of the England game as well, you know, it was a long stint to be sitting watching it.
Yeah.
Conditions couldn't have been any different, you know. And they even made that point in commentary. You went from a lovely autumnal night in London to it pouring down at Parwick Scarlets. So yeah, tough to play, and not a great game to watch.
Yeah,
but the game before it was all about defence. But that one thing I'm quite keen to pick up with Mike when he comes on is just the challenges in international rugby at the moment about attacking and fluency, because defences just seem to be on top when England's defence wage. I mean, especially the back, well, all of them, but the back row for Underhill and these guys, it's brutal, isn't it?
Yeah, like the English defence was probably my highlight of the weekend, if I'm honest. Just the intensity that they can sustain for the whole game. And like they bring on their bench and it's upped again. Mm. And like you say, the back row, I think they brought on Earl into the second half, and he comes on and straight in, getting turnovers, chop tackling people left, right and centre. Like it was just like a masterclass, wasn't it? Mm. From start to finish. And like you literally didn't see Ireland play the way they can at whatsoever.
So is that, it's almost a fantastic defence, it is. It's in terms of getting organised, getting up, having the physicality, always going forward. But is that, are they able to do that because of the way teams attack against them? Or is it just so dominant that it doesn't really matter what you do against England, you're going to face that? Because there must be a way of beating it. And yeah, there's attacking kicks that have to be executed on the money, right in the button, like we did see for Ireland's try. I think that is the way to combat that defence, but at the same time it means you're having to kick away a lot of possession, not kick away, but kick a lot of possession away and leave a bit to chance if the kick's not right on the money. So have England just got the perfect blueprint for international rugby, or should attacks be better?
I don't know, it seems that way a little bit at the moment. I think probably part of it is having like as multi-dimensional attack as you can, so that they can't always be so kind of fast off the line and in their face all the time, because, you know, you've got so many different options and you're using those options, I guess. But like you say, you've got to be spot on with what you do against a team like that. And at the moment, they are just so on form and so difficult to play against.
What would you do against them all?
Up the jersey, I think, Moshi.
Would you?
Of course you would.
I was going to ask you, the crossfield kick, I mean, how difficult a skill is it to execute? Like, they seem not like Johnny May's one of the best in the world at getting up, and his height helps. But what about the kick itself?
If you like anything, if you practice enough, it becomes better. And I do think you've got a stage now where most teams across the world, club, country, professional level, have players who can do it really, really accurately. So it becomes a viable option. I suppose when we were playing, it was a luxury option that, you know, if somebody could do. They could do it, but it was also a bit hit or miss. Whereas now it is on the money. They can bet on the money time and time again. And also, the reason you see more of it now is there's fewer players in the backfield defensively. So when we played, there'd usually be a pendulum or three covering the backfield really. Now there's sometimes only one when you're inside the opposition 22. So it leaves a lot of space for kick attack. And the players are really accurate. They practice more. It's more accepted, like, because it is one of the best ways of beating that blitz defence. So it's incorporated, as Rachel says, in your attacking strategy, whereas before it was just seen as a showboat or a luxury, but it wasn't a real strong part of your armoury, because you didn't really need it as much then as you do now. But you do need it. But in terms of how hard it is, it's it shouldn't be too difficult as long as you're moving forward on the ball. It's much more difficult if it's a poor pass, if you're on the back foot, you know, if you haven't communicated it early and the player's in the right position. So it's like anything, but it has to be in the armoury. You see high crossfield kicks now, you see low ones. So even the fact that it's not just a crossfield kick, you've actually got different grades of them, shows you how quick the players have to think on the field and how well they have to execute them, depending on what they're doing. But it's,
was it a Welsh game that it was the low crossfield kick?
If it was the second half, I was cooking my tea.
I can't remember if it was, but
they were talking about the
skill execution. I think it came off his shin. I'm not sure it was meant to be low.
Johnny May's kick and chase came off his shin, but
we need to talk about that Johnny May try. I mean, I saw him having a debate about him and when Chris Ashton scored a few years ago. We won't talk too much about the England game, but that Johnny May try was something a bit special, was it not?
Just unbelievable. I don't even really know what to say. It was just like unbelievable from start to finish.
And like, it does show their attacking ambition to go from their own 22.
Well, do you know what, right? This is going to sound crazy. Phenomenal, like brilliant. Individual piece of skill. His gas to outstrip all the cover and Irish defence when he hooked his kick in field. Like, he's actually had to run twice as far as everybody else. But his control at the end, like, utterly brilliant. Brilliant. However, there's always a but. It was Ireland's line-out. So would they have done that off England's line-out? Do you know what I mean? It's turnover possession. So that's instinctive brilliance from him and was it Henry Slade who gave him the ball? It was almost like shifted to him, almost just at instinct rather than plan. Now, if that was an England line-out, would they have done that? Probably not. But look what they could do, you know, with those players in the field. And I know it's easy to attack off turnover possession and, you know, the Irish defence that turned out wouldn't be set because they're set to attack. But a phenomenal try, but I suppose that's why you crave turnover possession. But it took a bit of scoring. It was similar, if we don't want to talk about Chris Ashton's one, Andy Craig had about an 80-metre gallop for that corner against England a few years back. The Scotland-England game is a pretty good try from a long way out as well, but we'll say that one was maybe better.
You mentioned, you know, Big Paul Connell was going to play the week at half-time because it was England did 7 in against Ireland 6, so just made it even harder to win the line-out in a day where the line-out didn't function well. But let's move on and talk a little bit about the Scotland-France game. Rach, starting with you, give us your thoughts. It's another one, a bit like we said with Glasgow, that, you know, and Stuart Hogg spoke at the end of the game about it as well. It could have been there, but ultimately they probably edged it physically.
Yeah, I think both teams, you know, you talked about being hard to play against. Both were quite hard to play against, and it was kind of who was going to let up first, I guess. And I think, you know, it wasn't the most exciting game of rugby. I think we spoke about it last week and thought it was probably going to be a bit more of a show than it was. But it was very tactically played, I think, you know, obviously a huge amount of kicking. But for me, I just felt like we needed a little bit of something else when it wasn't working, to try something different, to try and break that French defence. But yeah, it was all right. And yeah, we could have edged it, but I think France deserved it.
It's a tactical game, wasn't it, Mossy? Like, were you surprised that France, so many teams at the moment are going to the corner, and it was a game all of a sudden where teams were taking the points. Were you surprised in that?
I was surprised with the last penalty they took. I think it was the last penalty where they'd had two, just before opting to kick a goal, they'd had two really good line-out drives, one from halfway that drove probably about 15, 20 metres, and a second one a bit closer in that had a kind of 10-metre roll on it as well. I mean, they seemed to get the upper hand in that. It was just after France had replaced, I think, maybe a couple of front row, maybe two or three forwards, and before Scotland made their replacements. So it was almost that freshness and that cohesion. And after those two, they got another penalty and they decided to kick it a goal. Now it stretched the lead. So I was a little bit surprised, but I suppose it's what we'll talk to Mike about the kind of difficulties of international rugby, as we've been saying, how strong defences are. But I thought the first half was pretty good in terms of the physicality was very even. I think the two teams shared the good points of the first half. They were quite similar. And I think they shared the kind of the mistakes and the errors in the second half quite similarly, because I thought towards the end of the game, the structure was lost to a certain extent. There was a lot of handling errors. Yeah, it was pretty wet and showery. But it was almost as if there was, I don't know, like this lack of cohesion and lack of really attacking bite and mindset to go after the game. And I think that is international rugby at the moment. But they deserved to win it. The try they scored was excellent. The kind of set piece move. And I was doing radio commentary and I said a couple of times during the game, I get your view on this as well. Like, it seems to be now that the best time to attack is from set piece. I felt that the French defence got stronger and stronger and stronger as it went through the phases. So maybe between your strike attack and the next two phases after that, I just feel as if defence is getting so strong. Everybody's so fit. Everybody's so organised. They get back up on their feet. And away from the set piece, you've got a flat line. At least attacking from a set piece, you've got up to 16 players in one portion of the field. So I think we're going back to strike moves, and France pulled it a beauty on Sunday.
Yeah, I wonder whether that advantage from the set piece point of view is you've done your analysis, you know exactly where the setup you're going to be facing. So you know what lines and nines going to run from the back of a line out, the seven's going to run off the back of a scrum. So you've got the ability then to try and exploit that as well. Mm. I wonder, just going back to the line out, kicking the ball to a corner, taking the points, it was a big moment just before half time for Scotland to hold France out as they crossed the line but were held up, and Wayne Barnes under no doubt. I think that's so important at the moment. We talked about it pre-game with Glasgow, is that when a team smells blood and they go to the corner, a decent percentage of these, they're hard to defend at the moment, really hard to defend these moles. And you can see all the backs coming in adding their weight to it as well. So a big moment for Scotland.
The thing about that is, Rachel, you're still playing, so you'll be able to back up. But when you're up against it and then the opposition opt to kick a goal, I used to think, fair play, you know.
Yeah.
I'll take that decision. You know what I mean? If you've had sustained pressure on your line, it's almost like a win. Even if they kick the 3 points, it's almost like, you know, we've held them out. They have to, you know, kick the goal, obviously. But another thing I'd say about that, the defence for half-time was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Big moment in the match. But it's almost as if we had an old coach, Michael known well. Oh, you'll know well. Matt Williams, who used to talk about the championship minutes was his phrase. It's a term banded around a lot now. And it's true. The 5 minutes before and the 5 minutes after half-time being really crucial if you concede or score points in that window. And I think we got the point on Sunday where the 5 minutes before was brilliant, but then their try came in the 5 minutes after. So it's just having that focus both sides of the break. It's crucial.
One thing just I wanted to add on the set piece attack, just having played without many scrums recently, we've noticed a big difference in our ability to create chances to score. And our backs have talked a lot about, initially they thought they would really like not having scrums and having free kicks instead, but now they've found they have few opportunities where they have just backs v backs and that area to exploit and have that real kind of, I guess, one-on-one matchup. And I think, like you say, like it is a massive opportunity now, especially with the way defences are playing. And I think the way that our league's been down here has probably shown that as well.
I suppose as well, you do summon when you're scrummaging. So
some of us do.
I'm just looking at both the forwards looking up their bar. That was just a joke, folks. But the process of the scrummaging will exhaust you as well. So not only do you not get the opportunity with all these non-scrums or tap and goes in the law trials you're in at the moment, Rachel, the space isn't created by having 18 bodies in a small 16 bodies in a small field, corner of the field, but also that fatigue element's not building up because you're not working 6, 7, 8, 10 scrums a game.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you're seeing, you know, say you've got back rows who've converted to front rows at the moment, like quite a few of them in the women's game, and they're now playing like back rows again because they're not scrummaging. And it's really interesting because, you know, I'll use the example of Shauna Brown, who plays for England. She's was a back row and was converted to prop, and she at the moment is playing out of skin in the Tyrrells and picking up man of the match because she's playing like a back row like she used to. And then they've gone back and played against France at the weekend, a really tough scrummaging game, and it's really interesting to see how a game changes. And it's quite interesting now because the way our league is probably doesn't prepare us for international rugby. Yeah, but anyway, very much a side note.
As long as you keep lying out, Shin. I mean, if you six feet, yeah. Eight, you I mean, that's an absolute must. As I said earlier on, we were going to be joined by Mike Boyle, and he has graced us with his presence. Mike, how are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. I've been brought in especially for scrum and line out chat.
That's you, Michael. That's you.
To a T, you know how hard the forwards work in there.
Yeah.
If you had to give us some words of wisdom on scrum and line out, Mike, what would they be?
Well, to Al, a second row, you know, make sure you get lifted really well.
Brilliant.
Go hard in the scrums. Peter de Villiers, it's amazing like how forthcoming coaches are with their own specialist area. And I reckon the amount of times that we walk from the hotel over to Orium, and I'm walking with Peter and he's telling me everything about scrums. And like, actually, I'm quite interested in some of it, but you know, the days you just switch off and like, you know, you're kind of saying the same thing over and over again, just push a bit harder, you know?
Keep your head down, push hard.
We went to a couple of his scrum presentations actually, and like, they're really, really interesting. It's things that you wouldn't usually think about, like, you know, as a former nine putting the ball in, you don't think about the mechanics and the physics and everything involved in how you win a left shoulder, how you win a right shoulder. But it's actually, you know, now I'm not playing, it's actually quite interesting to look at it from that side of things.
Well, Mike, give us a bit of insight into your week. Obviously massively disappointed with the game being called off. But what does that mean for you and for the playing group? Is there an opportunity to rest, or have you got them in and working hard for the next game week?
Yes, so the decision was kind of left with the players as to what they wanted to do on an individual basis, whether you're Edinburgh player, Glasgow player or Exile. We've probably got about, we've got 10 or 11 in the hotel at the moment, a mixture of Exiles and people who want to stay away from their partners and families. So they're in at the moment. And then others have gone home. But like, you know, speaking to Scott Cummings, like, you know, he said he went home for 2 days and he just sat in his flat for 2 days and, you know, got a takeaway. And like, you know, you can do the same here, but mix with the guys as well. So a fair few have been here. We've had a optional kind of conditioning and skills session today. We'll do weights tomorrow and meetings, and then Friday kind of a little bit of training Friday, Saturday, then we go into the week. We obviously got to wait and see which game we're involved in, whether it's the Saturday game or the Sunday game, before we can nail down exactly what the week will look like.
And for you, well, for you especially as coaches, you'll have to prep for potential playing three different teams. So is that three times of work for you in the next 2 or 3 days, Mike?
It's certainly the analyst. Greg just had a word with the analyst today and said, you know, we'd like a presentation on England on Sunday night. But prepare for an Ireland presentation as well on Sunday night. So bearing in mind, I think the one of the games is on the Sunday, isn't it? Which game's on the Sunday?
I think the Italy-France is Sunday, is it? No. Ireland-Georgia Sunday, maybe.
Mossy, clear it up for us, Mossy.
I think it's Ireland-Georgia on the Sunday, isn't it? Wales-England and then France-Italy, I think, on the Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, I should know the answer.
So should I, to be honest.
All I was thinking was, I feel sorry for Gavin Marty, who have to prepare two presentations for us. But I mean, to be fair, the same thing happened last week, actually, because they gave us a presentation on the French squad that was initially selected for our game. And then, of course, the Fiji game was called off and they changed the squad completely. Mm-hmm. So Gavin Marty had to do another presentation on the kind of first team squad. So they're being worked hard.
Have you debriefed? We've kind of had a touch on the French game. We won't look too back for too long, but what were your kind of initial impressions of the performance? We spoke about the first half and the second half being a little bit different in terms of the kind of a lot of good in the first half, a few more mistakes in the second. Would that be fair?
Yeah, we were pretty pleased with the first half. The way we controlled the game, made France kick from a little bit deeper, put pressure on them. Whenever we had kind of concerted phases with that kind of five, six phases. We came out with penalties and points from that as well. So we're pleased with that side of things. Second half, it just didn't click as well. It was a little bit more kind of stop start for us. You know, them obviously getting the set piece try right at the start of that second half took a little bit of wind out the sails. But, you know, barring that, I think we're, like, it's strange, we're certainly not pleased with the result, but we feel we didn't play to the best of our abilities. We're playing probably one of the form teams in the world at the moment. And going into the last 10 minutes, we've got a great chance. You know, we're close to them. So there's some positive aspects, but weirdly enough, one of the most positive aspects is we didn't play that well, yet we're still in the game. Yeah. When maybe in the last 18 months, that might not have been the case.
There's some of that, Mike, about how much you allowed them to play as well. Like you said there, like they're one of the form teams in the world, if not the form team in the world. And when they get the balance to their game, they're incredibly hard to play against. So for me, one of the biggest positives was almost what we stopped them doing as opposed to what we did. Is that something you guys have discussed?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if you guys have talked about defence much kind of up to this point, but me and Mossy were speaking about it earlier on today. And like the way that the game's going, like defences are becoming more and more superior, the way that teams have got higher edges, so they kind of push play back inside a little bit more, means that you need to find other ways of breaking down defences. And we've used kicking to try and do this, to try and get counter-attack ball from kicks, turnover possessions, a good one to attack from. But yeah, I mean, certainly our defence has been, you know, a real strength of ours, and we didn't allow France to play a huge amount. And, you know, like Steve's Tandy's absolutely gutted with that kind of set piece try. He was saying today that he would have preferred that, you know, one of those kind of pick and go tries after 7, 8, 9 phases had been scored rather than that one, because they didn't have to work for it. So yeah, we're obviously really, really pleased on that side, I think, but it's a really good challenge for us from an attack point of view, that how do we break down those types of defences. And I think we did put pressure on the French at times. And as I said, in the first half, they started giving away penalties through it, but we didn't find that rhythm in the second half as much.
On that point about the set piece, Mike, we just spoke a few minutes ago about, well, I thought that it's becoming a better time to attack from set piece rather than multi-phase. I feel defences sometimes get stronger, the fitter, the faster. Yes, you could, I suppose, look to earn penalties through multi-phase attack. But is there a swing towards maybe the time to be attack? Is that set piece scrum, that line out, and really go after it there?
Yeah, I think so. We'd identified that watching a lot of the Super Rugby stuff during lockdown. The scrum in particular was an area we thought, right, you can really create mismatches through here, because you've got the 8 forwards and mainly targeting the front 5 from kind of second, third phase.
But the good luck problem,
Brad, and again, I don't know if you've talked about it, like the first 3 games we had, we ran one back play. Like just because we were either winning penalties or free kicks or the ball was a little bit scrappy or is, you know, kind of exit scrum. So, you know, from a scrum point of view, they're great, great places to attack from, but it's getting that
you
solid
need the scrum
base. Yeah. But line out as well, I think there's opportunities through that. And it's almost the kind of, you know, that between kind of second and third phase in those, because you'll generally find that defences are very set for those first 2 phases, very strict in what they're doing. But it's not until the next phase is when they start transitioning into, you know, 10 potentially moving into backfield or 9 moving back into the line. Those are the ones that you can almost start getting at teams from. But yeah, you need the set piece to be able to do that.
There's an element of that as well, Mike, that, you know, structured attack, structured defence from the set piece, you know who's going to go in and clear out that ball. So you've got designated ball carrier. You might have 2 or 3 options, but you know who's then going to come in and flush that. So you can generate quicker ball in those first 2, 3 phases as well.
Yeah, you can, but then it might be that teams are saying, right, for the first 2 phases, you know, we got those 2 men in the tackle. You're seeing more and more of these kind of choke type tackles. So we previously talked about, you know, like chopping low. And I think for, you know, 10, 20 years, it's always been that chop low, get them on the ground quickly. Whereas now it's moved into that kind of slowing the ball down a little bit. And although you might get momentum with a carry, then if those two players do a good job, then you're actually got your defensive line set and in place ready for the next one. So like it's a really interesting kind of battle between attack and defense, and what you're trying to do and how you can manipulate them. And I think, you know, you need to be smart with what you're doing in attack now to find any bends. There aren't huge amounts of, you know, free flowing rugby at the moment. Even the, you know, England against Georgia, when you think, right, you know, this is one of the top teams in the world against Georgia, you know, you think there's going to be free flowing tries and stuff. Like, you know, Jamie George scored 3 tries from driven mauls. You know, we scored, I think we were similar. So, you know, there's not as much free flowing rugby as you think there is in attack. So you need to find ways of getting around that.
Is that the same in your games, Rach? Are you similar, or are you still scoring quite regularly?
Did you not see the highlights of Rach carrying the ball right-handed off forward, and who ran it in, Rach?
Yeah, it was Sarah Bonner.
Sarah Bonner ran it in.
Easy.
Incredible. Free-fall in rugby.
Oh, wait, what are you talking about? You actually are talking about a try of help with Rona Lloyd.
Rona Lloyd, yeah.
We were talking rubbish there. I was like, I've never done that before.
Ah, you carried it in.
Yes, true, actually. Set up a nice try there. I think it varies in probably more in the women's game than it does in the men's at the moment. I think a lot of the good club teams down in England are playing really good free-flowing rugby. We're probably one of the teams who like throw the ball around a little bit and play really fast tempo. And then you've got teams like Quinns who were probably more traditionally big ball carrying type game and kick to the corner and drive to score, who still do that, but they are trying to, develop into a bit more of like multi-dimensional. At international, the big teams are the ones who are kind of top of the game in terms of who have that threat of a driving maul and a strong scrum, so like the likes of England, New Zealand, France. So probably more variation.
In club game
compared to international, yeah.
Mike, you've coached in the club game and the international game at the moment. That would be quite accurate as well, what Rachel's saying. More time together, more, I suppose discipline really to shape an attack, to be more creative when you've got more time together in a club than you do internationally. And when you play internationally, I suppose from an attacking perspective, you have less time, that fraction of a second less than you in the club game. So
yeah,
have you found a coaching there? Obviously, I assume it will be more difficult to coach attack in the international game as it would be in the club game.
Yeah, it's a lot different. As you said, there, working with Glasgow, you're there week in, week out. You can develop things. You can add layers to stuff over time. You know, you can get something right and then move on to the next thing. Whereas, you know, we don't have huge amounts of on-field coaching time. Probably in a working week, we'd have Monday would be half an hour of team. Tuesday would be 45 minutes of team. Thursday would be 35 minutes of team. So can't do the math on that, but it's about 2 hours of actual training time with the team. Like, you've obviously got your unit sections on top of that, but you've got your line out and scrum. You know, Peter and JD are fighting out for who gets extra time. You know, Steve comes in and does his attack, defense stuff as well. So like you've got to almost choose the most important things, what's going to make the biggest impact, and stick to these things. Because it's frustrating, because us as coaches, we have, let's say it's our last game was in March and then we played in November. So what's that? Seven months or so. And we're watching loads of rugby. We're in our heads, we're like, oh, we could do this, we could do that. And, you know, you've got 40, 50 ideas that you can do. But then you've got, you know, 2 hours in a week to implement them. So you've got to choose the ones. I've got so many good ideas. Well, I think they're good ideas, but you can't bring them in because you know, you've got to choose the most important things. And defensively, probably with the Six Nations and and this campaign here, the defense has probably been more the area that we've worked on. So attack, a little bit of a back seat to that. So we want to push that attack side through as well.
And as we look ahead, obviously no game this weekend, but we look ahead to whoever it is we play in the finals weekend. Just one change to the squad. Jacko van der Waal comes in to offer competition in the back line, the first receiver. Somebody who was training with the squad a few weeks back, but somebody who's caught your eye playing for Edinburgh.
Yeah, we're really pleased to be able to invite Jacko in. As you say, trained with us the first week of camp. And having him back in now is a big boost to our resources there. He's a really impressive character. Watching him play for Edinburgh, he's fully committed. He adds a lot to the Edinburgh team in terms of defence, attacking the line, his kicking game as well. And he's got a great attitude to get better and prove himself at the international level.
Right, Mike, always great to have a podcast favourite live inside the camp to join us. Good luck with the preparations for next weekend, and we'll catch up again soon.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, Mark. Always good to hear from Mike. Sounds as if they're having another busy week ahead of the following week. Moshi, correct me if I'm wrong, but the chances are, now I don't want to do Wales a disservice here, but the chances are we're going to play Ireland.
Yeah, it looks like that, yeah. Gregor said after the game on Sunday it would, you know, potentially be England, Ireland or Wales, but it looks like it would be Ireland if the results go as to form, I suppose, which would be Ireland and Dublin. When ironically that was the first test match of the year, wasn't it? 2020, the Six Nations first game was away in Dublin, and if that's the last one, then we'll, I suppose, on market progression, see how it goes.
Right. Before we sign off, it's worth touching. I know we've already covered the Glasgow Munster game, but on co-coms was Andrew Trimble, Ulster and Ireland legend. And it transpired last night when he arrived at Scotstoun that he had walked from Glasgow Airport, got the Renfrew ferry across into Yokart, and then walked up to Scotstoun. I mean, Rach, in all your time living in Glasgow, you ever walked back from Glasgow Airport?
Absolutely not. Was it not
absolutely
pouring in Glasgow last night as well?
It's horrible. It's blowing a gale. And we were like, what? He kind of dropped it in a conversation, didn't he, Alice? He says, oh, yeah, I just walked from the airport. And nobody really kind of took his word. Sort of, you what?
Well, I said Glasgow Airport, I think, at which point you said, well, it wasn't Prestwick. But I was just saying, what? You walked from Glasgow? He said it was only 5 miles when he Googled it, but it took him about 2.5 hours by the time he'd waited for a ferry and dotted across the Clyde.
In the rain, yeah. He said they got there early, nothing to do. Obviously, level 4 area, so he had a special letter from Premier Sports saying he could travel, and he didn't. He thought, well, why not? I'm here. I'll just walk, taking the sights. So he's
in the fresh air.
That was the glamour life, isn't it?
Never nice to end on a down note. Mossy, but really sad news coming out of French rugby with Christophe Dominici passing away suddenly this week. A man you would have played against many times.
Yeah, it's tragic. It's utterly tragic. It's one of these things where it just kind of hits you when you see the news. It just comes out of the blue totally, and it is tragic. I played a lot against Christophe Dominici, a really tough opponent for I suppose the listeners that can't remember him playing. He was a short, stocky, fast, really quick, dynamic Jinky winger, tough as to come, really aggressive as well, and he was kind of stereotypically French in the way he played, really kind of attack minded, and I didn't really get to know him personally. I didn't know him particularly well, but I faced him a lot, and he was a tough, like exciting player.
He was all action, wasn't he? He got the ball and he lit up a game.
He did, and it was from anything. I mean, it was tap penalties, it was kick chase, it was turnovers. I mean, he was the proper, you know, exciting talent, and spent a long time, a huge successful period at Stade Francais. I suppose the late 90s through the noughties, and won a lot of trophies there, won a huge amount of caps, played in 3 World Cups for France. A special talent. And as I say, somebody I didn't know personally, but I had huge respect for and met, opposite kind of wing or fullback on a few occasions. Just real, real tragic news.
Yeah, it's horrible news, and I'm sure there'll be a decent amount done to mark that over the coming games, next time French are on the park. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. Got some insight from Mike. Mossy and I know Mike well. You don't often get a serious Mike Boyle, but he's obviously got...
he's obviously getting old, eh? He's obviously getting old and mature. Because he's
grown up. He's grown up. It's nice to see. But we'll see everybody again. We'll see everybody again next week. No game for Scotland this weekend, but an exciting game to finish off the Nations Cup the following week.